Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello people, Ben here. Thanks as always for joining me for the latest episode of A Small Voice podcast, featuring conversations with a veritable plethora of wonderful, talented and inspiring photographers. So this is episode 77, for which my guest is the documentary photographer and filmmaker Nicole Sobecki, who is a member of the Seven Photo Agency. And a few weeks ago, I nipped over to Barcelona, where various Seven members were getting together for their annual general meeting, after which they went on to teach a number of workshops in the city. And this was all organised by Eyes in Progress, who exist to provide such events and who you should definitely check out if you're considering maybe partaking of a workshop or getting some mentoring. They're at eyesinprogress.com. Anyway, this was a rare opportunity to grab a number of people who don't get over to London very often. I figured if I could maybe fly in, do 6 interviews in 3 days, which I managed to do, thanks in part to the lovely Seven folk, who could not have been more accommodating despite the organised chaos of a full and ever-changing workshop schedule. And if you've ever been part of that process, either as a mentor or participant, you will know what I'm talking about. So, mission accomplished. And Nicole Sobecki is the first of those 6 chats. Who are the other 5 people? Shall I tell you? No, I don't think I will. Where's the fun in that? I think I might keep it under my hat for the time being. Before I introduce Nicole properly, I'm happy as ever to say that this episode is brought to you by the Charcoal Book Club, the world's first book of the month club, dedicated exclusively to photo books. I'm all joined up myself now. I just got my first book through the mail, and I have to say it was a joyous experience. The book is called Opening by Jingjin Lee, and not a photographer I was familiar with, and it's such a lovely thing. It's one of those accordion-style bindings which opens out so you can look at the book back to front and front to back, if you see what I mean. And it's lovely. And, you know, full disclosure and all that, the work itself is not really the kind of thing that I'm normally drawn to. But because it's so well done and the book itself is so beautiful, it really doesn't matter. I love it. And now I have a book that I would almost certainly not even have known about, let alone ending up owning it. And I guess that seems to me is the essence of being a Charcoal Book Club member. So, by the way, if you already own the book of the month and you let them know before they send it to you, they will simply replace it with something else of equivalent value from their expertly curated selection. So how does it work? Each month, Charcoal works with the most respected photographers and publishers in the industry to send hand-picked books directly to your door. Whether you're a professional artist or a photographer with a stock library or a novice who's just beginning to build their collection, Charcoal Book Club is an easy and affordable way to stay up to date on the most essential work in contemporary photography. The club offers free shipping to the UK, Canada and the US, and members get exclusive perks such as signed copies, access to rare titles, members-only pricing in their online bookstore and more. April's book, by the way, guest curated by Alex Soth, no less, is Iowa by Nancy Rexroth, of which Alec has said, thinking of that book is like recalling a dream, simultaneously dark and light, vivid and blurred, and wrapped in cotton candy, or is it Pepto-Bismol, clouds of pink, even the book's title seems like a dream. And as always, leaving the best bit until last, Charcoal are still extending a very special introductory offer exclusively to Small Voice listeners when you sign up any photo book of your choice from their library for free. Go to charcoalbookclub.com and use the special code ASMALLVOICE when you sign up to receive your free book. So for the latest and greatest photo books delivered to your door with free shipping and no hassles, check out thecharcoalbookclub.com, where they're on a mission to inform the mind and inspire the soul, which they certainly are doing. If you like the podcast, please leave a review on iTunes. You can kick in a small recurring monthly donation at bensmithphoto.com/asmallvoice. If you need a new Squarespace website but don't have the time, patience or inclination to do it yourself, let me know and I'll do it for a ridiculously low fee. Thus ends the introduction. So Nicole Sobecki is an award-winning photographer and filmmaker based in Nairobi, Kenya, and represented internationally, as I have said, by the photo agency Seven. Nicole graduated from Tufts University before beginning her career in Turkey, Lebanon and Syria, focusing on regional issues related to identity, conflict and human rights. From 2012 to 2015, Nicole led Agence France-Presse's East Africa Video Bureau, and was a 2014 Rory Peck Awards news finalist for her coverage of the Westgate Mall attacks in Kenya. Her work has been recognised by Pictures of the Year, the One World Media Awards, the Alexandra Bulat Award for Photojournalism, the Magenta Foundation, and the Jacob Burns Film Centre, among others. Nicole sits on the board of Tufts University's Programme for Narrative and Documentary Practice, founded by Gary Knight. And she is also a contributor to Everyday Africa, a collection of images shot on mobile phones across the continent, and an attempt to showcase the moments missing from dramatic news images, everyday life that is neither idealised nor debased. Nicole aims to create photographs and films that demand consideration for the lives of those represented, their joys, challenges, and ultimately their humanity. She's completed assignments throughout Africa, the Middle East, and Asia for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, National Geographic, Newsweek, Time, Foreign Policy, the FT Magazine, The Guardian, and Le Monde, and her work has been exhibited internationally. So please do enjoy my chat from Barcelona with Nicole Sobecki. We could start with last night and the panel that you were part of for the Women of Seven, mm-hmm. the Seven Women of Seven. It was what was the title of the talk? Did it have a?
It was called What Now?
What Now? That's right. Okay, yeah. As if it might need explaining, it was really about the representation of women in the photo industry and. Mm-hmm. And what could be done to redress the imbalance? Because it is a very male-dominated business, and it is very patriarchal. You very interestingly said, you want pragmatic, meaningful, actionable solutions. And I was sitting there thinking, because at the end of the day, there needs to be something pragmatic done. Yeah. I mean, in terms of Seven, is there any kind of a definite plan or roadmap in terms of, increasing the percentage of women? Because there's seven of you, there's 28 photographers, that's 25% as things stand. Is that an acceptable balance, or is there a concrete plan to do something about that?
I mean, I think that we all wish that we were born into a world where this sort of 50-50 equality already existed. But it doesn't. And so we have to kind of step by step push for that type of change until we achieve it. I think, bringing in six women photographers in this recent, this recent round of new membership was a very meaningful step in the right direction.
Okay, so six out of seven of you have only just joined. Is that the fact?
Exactly.
Okay. I didn't realize that. Yeah.
So that was a very purposeful move by Seven to recognize that this imbalance has existed and take a meaningful step towards bringing in more diverse voices on issues related to gender. And I think down the line, we're going to be looking at bringing in a diversity of voices that speaks to regional imbalances, and in many other forms of diversity.
Yeah, so I guess, like you say, really, that's quite a symbolic act on the part of Seven. And that's definitely to be applauded that they did that. I mean, we can't really call them out for, not taking some kind of action. And maybe, hopefully the other agencies will follow suit,
hope the whole industry is, begins to move more and more in this direction.
Yeah. I mean, should we have some kind of positive discrimination on the part of picture editors, where they just say, well, I'm gonna hire women, and that's it? Is that possible?
I think it's complicated because ultimately none of us want to be hired because we're women. We want to be hired because we're great photographers, right? And we care a lot about our work and we are dedicated and invested in telling these stories.
Sure, but I
think that what we've seen happen over and over again is that we are living in a world that's built on the patriarchy, and what's familiar and comfortable and what editors know is generally a world in which white men have led this industry forward for many decades. And so I do think that it's not enough to say, I'm just hiring the best photographer, because you may not even know what's out there. There has to be a conscious effort to hire diverse voices, but also seek out and understand photographers working outside of your familiar comfort zone, photographers that you might not have heard of but are producing beautiful, meaningful work in all different parts of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose a practical consideration if you're sitting there on a picture desk is who's going to deliver, you know, the goods, and therefore there's a tendency to stick with the people that you know that you can rely on, as it were. So that is a kind of leap in a way to say, well, I'm going to try, you know, someone I don't necessarily know. And whether that's a person of colour or a woman or whatever, you know, it's the same issue. But yeah, I mean, it is a very interesting issue, I think.
And I'm absolutely not saying that. I think that there are enough talented women photographers, photographers of colour, photographers in more regionally diverse and overlooked parts of the world, that those often are the best person for the job, not only because they're dedicated and talented, but because they understand the context in which they're working in a way that somebody who is popping in for a week might not. So to me, this is about caring about storytelling and trying to do our best to understand this complicated, messy world that we're all in. And I think that we can do that better if we have more diverse voices telling those stories. So it's not about choosing a second or third rate option when, you know, you want to go with what you know and trust. It's about recognizing that what you know and trust, because it's built on a structure that is very narrow and exclusive, may not always be giving you the best choice.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, I'm talking in terms of positive discrimination. I mean, I wouldn't dream of suggesting that, as you say, someone should be hired just because they're women. It's a given that your qualities as a photographer are there and are equal to, you know, the white guy standing next to you, and therefore, given the choice of those two options, then, you know, go with the woman, because you're not being chosen as a kind of token. You're being chosen because you are going to deliver. You are a good photographer. And same if you're, you know, as you say, a person of colour or whatever. I'm just a white bloke, so, you know, it's quite difficult to talk about these things. You know, I'm a middle-aged, you know, white Western guy.
Look, I mean, just, you know, there are a lot of people who are very close to me in my life who fit many different profiles. So this isn't to say there's one type of voice that can be having this conversation.
Right.
I think, you know, what's really important moving forward is that we all engage and we all question our own privilege, and that, you know, I'm very privileged in many ways, and so are you, and so are many people in this industry. And just to be kind of much more introspective and thoughtful about that, and recognizing the opportunities that we've been given and how we can pay that forward to talented, driven people who may not have the same opportunities.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Well, you know, it's as you say, it's a fascinating, you know, dynamic and debate, and it will, you know, it will continue, and we, you know, it comes up a lot on the podcast, so it will be a sort of ongoing conversation. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about you. I like to get the superhero origin story, as I like to say, you know, if you are ever into comic books, which is a very bloke thing. But where are your family's roots?
So I was born and raised in New York.
Yeah.
My parents originally from Ohio, sort of Midwestern transplants to New York.
Right.
And
originally, I mean, Sebeki, what's the origins of that?
So both of my parents are half Polish. So it's Sobieski, and then it got changed to Sobeki at Ellis Island.
Okay.
So Sobeki is the sort of Americanized Polish surname.
Right.
My parents are originally from Ohio. Moved to New York before I was born. My dad was actually working at Kodak in Rochester, New York when I was born.
Right.
So my family likes to joke that the photochemicals kind of seeped into the womb.
I like that. Yeah. Yeah, that kind of makes sense. So when did the photography become a thing for you then?
I mean, I think it's easy to try to kind of pinpoint this one moment, and I can do that, but it's I think really comes from kind of longer interest in literature and history and art. And then beginning slowly, and as I became a teenager, to recognize that this was actually a job that people had to go out there and do. You know, seeing images in the newspaper and having that connection that there was somebody the other side of that who was there witnessing history unfolding, documenting it, making me aware of what was happening in a place that, you know, at that point felt very far away.
Mm. And did you sort of pull through news magazines and that kind of thing, or was it just newspapers, or what was your kind of exposure?
I think a lot of it came from newspapers and then books.
Right.
So I do have a very sort of distinct memory of, I used to love going to bookstores and spending hours rifling through the stacks and finding Inferno by James Nakhwe and just being totally blown away, and sitting, just going through every page of this book. And there was definitely a moment of saying, you know, maybe this could be me. Maybe I could be out there trying to tell these types of stories.
That's a good one to discover if you're going to, you know, get into photojournalism. I guess this is probably as good a body of work as any to be inspired by.
Absolutely. And I later had the privilege of interning for him my freshman year at university. And I remember I wrote this very earnest letter asking for a job and listing all my qualifications that I didn't quite believe at the time. And the last one being that I made very good coffee.
Right. So never to be underestimated. Coffee's becoming a bit of a theme here because, as I said, you for the listeners who haven't seen, the seven photographers did a little thing. I think it might have been in collaboration with Think Tank, the bag company, but they did a thing called What's in My Kit Bag or whatever, which is always, you know, we all like to look at what, you know, gear people are using, but in yours was a coffee grinder, which I thought, you know, definitely was an indication of some of your priorities, that you would be prepared to grind your own coffee beans while you're out there in the field.
Yeah, I mean, I've been based in Nairobi, Kenya for the last 6 years, and they actually have wonderful coffee there, but in many places I work, it's Nescafe, and when you have that pre-dawn wake up, that doesn't always cut it.
Yeah, absolutely. So when did it become a bit more serious for you then?
So I went on from there to study fine arts at the School of the Museum of Fine Arts and Political Science at Tufts University. And I had the privilege while I was there of engaging with a group of students in a student-run documentary and photojournalism program called Exposure, which was extremely exciting. And we actually built a relationship with some members of Seven Photo Agency there, who helped run workshops in correlation with the university. So I had the opportunity to take workshops with Gary Knight in Kosovo, in Cambodia, and you know, bring some of these photographers to the university to speak and have exhibitions. And so that was a sort of amazing outlet into this world.
Yeah, and I think Gary Knight runs a course there, or is involved, or did run a course
there. Yeah, for many years.
Yeah, for the listeners who don't know, Gary Knight's obviously one of the founders of the Seven. So your relationship with Seven and with him kind of goes back a long way.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. And you know, when did your relationship with Africa start? Because you live there, as you said, in Kenya now, and you've done a lot of work there, probably the majority of your work. What was your first experience of Africa?
My first experience was when I was around 14 and I did a student exchange program for a summer, and I lived in Ghana. And, it was my first time on my own in a place that felt very unfamiliar. It was terribly exciting.
Mm. Was it slightly scary as well?
It was new. Mm. You know, I mean, I don't think that teenagers have that much fear.
True. Yeah. It's true. Yeah.
Which is, can be a bit blind as well. But I had a wonderful experience and came back kind of excited and determined to find a way somehow to return. And eventually in university, I did some research in Rwanda and Eastern Congo. And then after several years living in Istanbul, Turkey, I made my way back to Nairobi, which has been home for the last 6 years. Mm.
So how did you end up in Istanbul?
Well, I worked in for a, I started out actually originally in Beirut, Lebanon, working for a small English language newspaper, The Daily Star.
As a sort of staff photographer?
As an intern.
As an intern, okay.
Yeah.
But you were shooting pictures?
I was shooting pictures and writing about everything from graffiti on the streets of Beirut to eventually at the end of my time there, there was a small conflict that broke out in northern Lebanon, the Nahr el-Bared refugee camp. And so that was also the first time I saw and covered conflict.
Mm. And what was your reaction to that? What was, did you feel that this was something you could, that could be part of your future? Specifically the conflict stuff, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I think that at the time I was just trying to learn as much as I could from the people around me who had done this before. Some of them had done it many, many, many times before, to try to do it responsibly and thoughtfully and as safely as you as I could.
Mm. Who were some of the people who you were learning from?
Well, I had been very lucky, actually, to meet a photographer who's still a good friend of mine, Brian Denton, on one of Gary's workshops back when I was 18. So when I moved to Beirut, he was a photographer that I knew from that time and became a good friend and still is, along with his wife. And we, you know, kind of grew up in the industry together in that sense.
Mm. So you had someone to sort of show you the ropes, as it were.
Yeah, he was a few years older than me. Yeah. And then I met many, many wonderful photographers during that time who were incredibly supportive and collegial and to who I owe a lot.
So did you have a plan of any sort, as it were? Or were you just kind of, like you say, you were trying to get as much experience as possible? But you know, by that time, obviously, you realized that, this was something that was going to be a career. What was your approach to building that?
Well, I went back and finished up my degree, and then I ended up applying for and getting a job as the Turkey correspondent for a startup that was trying to invest in international coverage, news coverage, called the Global Post, mm-hmm. which is now defunct, but was for me and I think for many others a sort of opportunity to take that leap, to go abroad, to have, you know, this sort of small but meaningful salary and the ability to kind of know that you could pay your rent at the end of the month.
Yeah.
and then, you know, try to build your skills and your craft and your network and connections to various newspapers and magazines. And
Right. Was there a big break as such, or was there a particular thing that you can think back on as a moment of a kind of inflection point in your kind of development?
I don't know about a big break in that sense. I think it's felt a lot more like a evolution of just trying to build out my capacity as a storyteller and, you know, and also build out my confidence to invest in the stories that I feel most driven to tell and that feel most important to me and most intuitive.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of those stories then. What was your first? Was it the Eritrea thing that you did, Shadow Migrants?
In the first story in Africa?
Yeah, in terms of the chronology, yeah.
Well, I actually began covering Africa while I was still based in Istanbul. The New York Times sent me to South Sudan to cover the referendum and independence there, which was an extraordinary moment that I now reflect back on with a very different perspective, knowing that this is, you know, undercovered and deeply entrenched conflict in the region. But at the time was, you know, felt like this moment of transition. People were joyful and celebrating. Returnees were coming in from Khartoum and other parts of Sudan to, you know, live again in this new country, voting for the first time, celebrating their independence. And it was incredibly exciting, if, you know, if only because I didn't understand the context well enough at the time.
Mm.
And from there, I did some work in Somalia. And when I was ready to really make a move, Nairobi was the natural base to
right,
shift towards.
Right, okay. But I mean, I guess I'm talking in terms really of your own story, your own projects, really. You know,
yeah.
Was the Shadow Migrant story, was that one of the ones that you kind of...
That was a project that I worked on with Matina Stavis from the Wall Street Journal, who is very passionate about the refugee crisis and had developed this story because at the time, you know, Eritrea is a very tiny country, but in a per capita ratio, there were more Eritreans fleeing to Europe than there were Syrians. And there was very little coverage or understanding of the, you know, tremendous flow that was leaving that country. And because it has been so difficult to access and begin to understand exactly how things are happening on the ground there, it felt a little bit like this sort of black box. And if we could go and speak with the refugees who had just crossed the border into Ethiopia from Eritrea, maybe there would be an opportunity to gather insights into what was happening in that black box and what was pushing this massive influx of people right. from their country.
And I guess which are the projects that are closest to your own heart in terms of either ones you've done or ones which you're still working on, would you say?
I mean, my project in Somalia with my reporting partner, Laura Heaton, is definitely... something extremely meaningful to me.
Is this Climate for Conflict?
This is a Climate for Conflict.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about that.
So this is a story looking at how climate change and environmental degradation are fueling conflict and migration in Somalia. And I became interested in it because of this sort of environment security links, this way of this sort of space to enter that conversation, because for me, I mean, climate change is something I'm extremely passionate about and terrified by.
Mm.
And yet it's something that I think is very hard to communicate. There are images of the melting glaciers and the polar bears, but there's something about that that feels very abstract and potentially far off. There's a part of the conversation that speaks of this sort of, you know, my children and my grandchildren, and that's just frankly not the case. People are being impacted by this now. Global security is increasingly being impacted by issues related to our environment. And this is something that the Pentagon and the military understand very well, but I don't think has been fully understood by the general public. And so Laura and I were looking for a way to try to tell that story, and she discovered this amazing archive of photographs from the late 70s and early 80s that had been part of the only comprehensive land survey ever done in Somalia. There were literally thousands of points that were mapped out on the ground and through aerial photographs as a sort of scientific study to understand the geography and flora and fauna and various things. This was led by this enigmatic British scientist, Dr. Murray Watson, who in 2008 was kidnapped in Somalia. This archive had been sitting in the countryside, British countryside, at the home of a colleague of Dr. Watson's, and really never been seen before. So we tried to take these photographs, scan the negs or scan the slides, and then go back to Somalia and re-photograph some of those same locations to understand how, in this relatively tiny amount of time, 35 years roughly, the landscape had changed dramatically.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a climate change denier in the White House, so things are pretty serious. Are you pessimistic about, you know, the fact that that climate change seems to me anyway to be the kind of defining issue of our times, and yet, as you say, people don't seem to be taking it as seriously as I think perhaps they ought to be.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this is the defining issue of our time, I mean, among other things, but certainly one of the most important to be focused on. And I get very emotional and angry at some of the politicking around this topic, because we all share this planet, and it's in all of our own best interests to take this seriously. And to take this seriously now, because we don't have time to take this seriously later.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what's happened up to now, you know, that it's been deferred, as it were, by each generation, and now we're at a point where that isn't an option anymore, you know,
it's
and
it's urgent. It's not an option. I was actually in Marrakesh with Laura and the Ground Truth team who helped support and fund this project, as Trump was elected. And it was, as you can imagine, a really grim scene the next day at the COP climate change global conference. Everyone recognizing that the advances that had been made in Paris the year before were going to be stepped back.
Yeah.
And at a time when it has never been more urgent to move forward as impactfully as we can, as quickly as we can. But I think in terms of, you know, looking at this issue as a storyteller, it's a challenge because climate change is so massive and so overwhelming that I think that there's a point at which people just sign off emotionally. This is happening. There's nothing we can do about it. Let me move on with my day. And I get that. It's a very sort of human response to something that is so potentially catastrophic. And I think that we need to be creative in our approaches to try to bring home the reality of this in a way that pushes for action instead of apathy.
Yeah. For Climate for Conflict, you also shot video because you are someone who does both. Always have or have for a long time.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about that. I talked a little bit with Ed Cashy about it yesterday as well. And obviously quite a lot of Seven people are, you know, definitely exploring, you know, both options. But from your point of view, I mean, do you find it difficult to sort of flip from one to the other? Is there a kind of conflict in a way in your own head?
I mean, I think that there's two answers to that. And one is the kind of in the field answer.
Right, that's the thing. Exactly, that's the point. Yeah. And then there's the kind of more abstract. Well, answer, you know, both questions, as it were, one at a time.
Well, I think that when I'm in the field working on a story, I try very consciously to not be doing them at the same time if I don't have the time to do them both well. To be thoughtful about how I'm approaching a story. And that's not always possible. In Somalia, it wasn't really possible because it's so difficult to get to these remote parts of the country because of the security situation and the expenses that you entail to work there because of the security situation. So we were absolutely, I mean, Laura and I were supporting each other and working very hard to get as much material as we could from each trip there. But in a more general sense, when that's not such an extreme situation, I prefer to say, you know, today I'm doing this, or this is my priority in this situation, or I will do both, but only if we add on some time so that they can both do well, because the last thing you want to do is leave a situation feeling like, well, I've done these two things to an adequate degree.
I've done two things, but none of them particularly well.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. But I do think in the bigger picture that engaging with filmmaking informs my photography, and my photography informs my filmmaking, and they both support each other in my sort of understanding of approach. And I often think about my photography in a way that feels a little bit more cinematic, maybe in sequencing and thinking through how images relate to one another. And I think certainly my background in photography changes the way that I look through a video camera.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I might as well ask you about the thing. You won a Rory Peck Award, which is one of the main kind of...
Finalist.
Finalist, sorry, you didn't win it, but you're a finalist. I'm sorry, yeah. Yeah, that's one that's for, I guess, you know, sort of video photojournalists. And you were at the Nairobi terrorist attack on the Mall, which I think is quite near where you live, right?
It's about 10 minutes away from where I live. Yeah.
Okay. So that was, you know, just right place, right time, if you want to look at it that way. Tell me a little bit about that experience.
So, you know, as you said, I live about 10 minutes away from Westgate Mall. It's a place that I would buy groceries at, go see a film, meet friends for a coffee, you know. And when I was at home at the time, actually packing for a trip to Israel, I was doing a story on global breast cancer with the New York Times, and about to kind of pack all my cameras away when we heard that there was something happening at Westgate, and it was very unclear what that was. The first rumor was that it was a robbery, and then the rumors kind of went out in all directions from there. Mm. I was working as the East Africa video coordinator for AFP at the time, so I called my editor and asked if he had heard anything, which he hadn't, but he soon called me back and said, you know, I think maybe you should just go down there. And so I grabbed my flak jacket and helmet and cameras and went down to the Mall. It was immediately clear that this was not a robbery. The fear on people's faces as they were streaming out of the Mall, people clutching strangers, sobbing. It was really dramatic. And eventually, and you know, reached an area where a bunch of journalists had gathered, quite just on the outside of the Mall, and saw that there were ambulances going up to the upper parking lot along this ramp, and decided to try to see if I could get up there to get into the Mall to see what was going on. And I managed to get there and link up with a group of armed civilians, off-duty police officers, people in private security, but everybody going in as a civilian because their Kenyan response took hours. And so the majority of the hundreds of people who were safely evacuated from the Mall were evacuated by these men. And it was something quite extraordinary. So I spent a few hours going around with them as they were trying to get civilians out of the Mall safely. And eventually the military did come in and kick us out. But
really? And they took ages. Why did they take so long to arrive? Presumably they sent police and military, or?
Yes. Yeah, so it was the first responders that I saw that were not civilians were the military.
Right.
But the fact that it took hours to achieve that is an incredibly irresponsible, condemnable moment for the Kenyan government.
Yeah, it's terrible. And, you know, how did you find your response to having to function, you know, professionally under those circumstances? Was it quite instinctive for you to just do the job. I presume there was quite a lot of fear going on, you know, at the same time for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think anyone who says that they're not afraid in those situations is naive or numb or lying. I always feel afraid in those situations.
Or a sociopath. None of them are good.
But I think that you do have to manage that. Yeah. You have to manage it not only for your own sake and your capacity to actually do something useful. And you know, in this case, I was filming. In other cases, I've taken photographs. And make sure that you know you're there for a purpose, and that your time and the risk that you're taking is productive, but also to make sure that you're not putting yourself or any of the people around you in greater harm. So you feel afraid, and then you try to manage it as responsibly as you can.
And in that case, it was sort of a no-brainer for you to take your video. I mean, because of the job that you were doing at the time,
exactly.
You were involved in the video side of things, so you shot the with the video camera on that particular occasion.
Exactly. I mean, I was the video bureau chief for AFP in East Africa, but I was also shooting stills for them. But in that moment, there were other really talented, capable photographers, and there was nobody else shooting video. So it felt like, I think we do have to ask ourselves in these situations, not only what are we driven to do, but what can we contribute to the conversation? What can we contribute to the understanding of this event or this moment or this theme? And that felt more valuable at the time to me.
Right. Going back to Climate for Conflict, sometimes it's nice to talk about individual images, I think, and kind of get a little bit of the story behind them. And there was one in particular, which I think you've kind of singled out in the past, of the woman in the desert with, I don't know, what do you call that thing that she's wearing?
She's a very long scarf.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And it's a very striking image. The colour, the way in which the kind of colours that she's wearing and the colours of the actual picture are just so beautifully kind of, sympathetic, as it were. Tell me a little bit about that picture. And my listeners can obviously find it, you know, online while they're listening. And I'll probably put it on the website maybe, but tell me about it.
So this is an image that I took in Western Somaliland in 2016 during a drought. And we had actually gone on that trip with a slightly different plan in mind. And then by the time that we got there, the drought had worsened significantly, and we decided to restructure our trip and spend some time in that region of the country, which was horrific. I mean, just you would drive on these sort of dusty, dry roads, and there were just animal carcasses, that just littered the sides of the roads, and people were dying as well. And communities that have sort of traditional, I mean, just I guess a little bit of context is that this is a primarily pastoral community. Most people make their living by herding animals, and so when a drought hits, those animals are their home, their bank account, their car. I mean, to lose that in equivalent terms would be if a fire destroyed your bank, your home, your car, your, you know, all at once.
Yeah, it's everything.
It's everything. And so we came across this scene where some women were on the side of the road, and there was a small puddle of water that they'd found, and they were doing their laundry in that because it was the only water that they could find. They had sort of done their laundry, it was drying out, and then in this image, they're returning home. And what I guess was meaningful for me about this image, looking at it, is the relationship between this woman and the environment that she's in, because that was essentially the point we were trying to make in this narrative, is that there are many different ways of covering this story, but for us, it was very important to make this a very human story. There are people who are being dramatically affected, pushed into impossible choices, forced to make dramatic life-altering decisions, now in many parts of the world, and Somalia has been among the most hard hit countries in the world by climate change, which is ironic because it's also one of the countries in the world or one of the regions in the world that has contributed least to emissions. So
yeah, that kind of figures.
So that relationship between this woman and, you know, this human being and her environment, which is changing so quickly, why that image has sort of resonated, I think.
Yeah, it was almost one of those little gifts from the photo gods that, you know, had this symbol. But were you very much aware of it at the moment, or was it later when you kind of looking through the pictures that the full kind of significance of it in your own head had kind of came to mind? Do you remember thinking at the time, oh, wow, this is kind of something?
You know, I did kind of run after her a little bit. So there is something that I saw there, but not in the full context.
No, right,
There's often two stages of trying to understand even your own work, let alone someone else's. So,
of course. Did you throw a bit of flash in there, or is that just the way the light was?
That's actually just the way that the light was, and the fact that the material that she's wearing is slightly reflective.
Awesome. Very cool. So one of the things I like to kind of get a sense of is what I like to call the income pie chart, because we're now all essentially by necessity having to figure out multiple revenue streams. What does yours look like? Broadly speaking, in terms of where those different streams come from.
Yeah. I would say that where I'm at right now is probably not where I'll be in 5 years. So it's a constantly changing pie chart as our industry evolves very quickly. Right now, the majority of my, you know, income comes from my sort of daily bread, comes from assignment work. And I use that, whatever I have left from that to try to invest in my personal work, to also be applying for grants and fellowships. The Somalia Project, for example, would have been impossible to do without the support of the Ground Truth Foundation, the Ground Truth Project. So I have been lucky to kind of do the majority of my work through those two streams. But I think that's changing, and I'm looking and thinking creatively about how to expand my commercial work for obvious reasons.
Yeah. It's a good earner if you can actually establish that side of things, and that brings in some of the money that you can then go and use for.
And it's another way of using your brain, another way of being creative. I think, and I think another thing that I care a lot about, which at times brings in income, at times doesn't, but is, I think, extremely important regardless, is the idea of investing more heavily in education. So there are ways of doing that are income generating, and then there are ways of doing that are more of a commitment to expanding the resources in places that don't necessarily have the same educational opportunities as other parts of the world. We'll be doing a workshop in Nairobi with Danny Wilcox Fraser in November, and we have two scholarship slots for East African photographers, and that's a very small beginning to what I hope will be more expansive opportunities in the region.
Right, okay. And I guess, being in Nairobi, being a kind of Western photographer in Nairobi, presumably that's in a way quite good for you in terms of getting assignments, because people know you're out there, and, if there's a job going there in Kenya, you got a decent chance of getting it. Was that part of your rationale for basing yourself there? Was that kind of incidental, really?
I mean, there's kind of two sides of that coin. I think Africa is still the least covered continent, maybe aside from Antarctica. I think it's a place that needs more nuanced storytelling and more people out there engaging in that space. And me being there as an outsider is one part of that. It's not the most important part of it. The most important part of it is to expand opportunities for people to be telling their own stories. And that's where education fits in. Mm. But until I become irrelevant, I think it's important to have the voices of both insiders and outsiders. But it's a region I care tremendously about. It feels like my home. It has been for the last 6 years, and I plan to stay there for a while.
You do? Okay. Yeah.
I mean, to some degree, I don't like to be in a situation where I'm elbowing other photographers or being elbowed by them and trying to all take the same photograph. That's not very interesting to me. So I do like to be in a space where, you know, you can really be thoughtful about what stories need to be told, and generally you're going to be there telling them and I think contributing in a more meaningful way, because if you weren't there, maybe that story wouldn't get out into the world. But Africa is heavily stereotyped, and I think part of that is because coverage is thin.
Right.
And so the most dramatic events rise to the surface, and then that's all that gets told. So the more we can kind of begin to look at that more thoughtfully and explore different types of storytelling on the continent, the better people will begin to understand this place that I think is really absolutely exceptional. And complicated and diverse, and you know, deserves a much more committed degree of storytelling in the international media, and the opportunity to develop local and regional media to a greater degree.
Mm. I think you've been involved with Everyday Africa, haven't you? Which is, it's kind of apposite to that, because really, I guess the intent behind that is to show, you know, normal life, which doesn't conform to the stereotypes that we're used to seeing. Is that essentially what that's for? Because it's a kind of, what is it? It's a collective or an online
Yeah,
thing?
It's a collective is a good word. It's a group of photographers that, you know, share the goal of trying to create a space to tell more textured nuanced versions of what Africa is and how we understand it. It's majority African photographers or photographers living and working on the continent. And if you're there, you already know this. You know that how this, you know, space is portrayed in mainstream media is a tiny sliver of the reality that you live every day. But if you're not there, and most people aren't, I think that you see what's in the news. And so we were trying to create a platform to distribute and share images of how we see and understand this space. And that, you know, there's at the time of the publication of our book, which we launched in Nairobi last May, there were 30 photographers, and that's now expanded even more dramatically. And the everyday movement has grown into, we now just on the continent have everyday Ethiopia, everyday Zimbabwe, many, and then there's everyday Latin America, everyday Middle East, everyday climate change. And so I think the idea is to kind of try to, you know, Instagram is this extraordinary self-publishing platform where we have the opportunity to, you know, skip over the gatekeepers and publish our own perspectives on the world. And this was a way of us kind of harnessing that together to try to combat these stereotypes.
Mm. So you're quite positive about the way in which social media and Instagram has become a kind of part of the landscape, as it were, in terms of being a storyteller and you know, it being a new avenue, really, for showing work.
I mean, I think that it's the reality.
Yeah.
And so, you know, on a very personal level, I would probably prefer to just, you know, read newspapers and literature and move a little bit slower. But that's just not the world that we live
in. I'd quite like to be living in the 50s, personally. I don't know why the 50s, but I just chose that at random. Yeah, yeah.
But I do think it's incredibly exciting. And Instagram in particular, as a photographer, is this sort of amazing space to, as I said, self-publish and tell stories on your own terms. Mm. It's a complementary medium. It certainly doesn't replace newspapers and magazines, and I don't think it ever should. But it's as a complementary space to share images, I think it can be incredibly powerful.
Mm. I mean, you're of the generation, you're a digital native, aren't you? I mean, you never really had any experience with film when you first became interested, or did you?
Well, because I started out doing news in the digital
age, yeah.
I've done the majority of my work on digital cameras, although part of the Somalia project that was a lot of fun for me was going back with a Hasselblad and a Hasselblad X-Pan and moving more slowly because it was a project that I worked on for 2 years. And because, I mean, I chose to do that not just for the sake of using film, but because I wanted to try to capture these sort of vast landscapes and portraits with a certain sensibility. And those cameras were just better tools to do that.
Yeah.
But yes, the majority of my work has been digital and will continue to remain so.
Mm. Any book projects in the pipeline or on the horizon for you? Do you have anything planned, or do you have any ambition to make a book?
I mean, I love books. So it's kind of space in which I enjoy collecting other people's books. I take a lot of inspiration from that. And someday, absolutely. But I also think it has to be the right fit. I don't want to make
a bad one.
Well, and I don't want to make a book for the sake of making
a
book. Exactly, I want to make a book because it's a distinct, specific medium that I think can be very impactful, but has to be done with the right project. It has to be done thoughtfully. So I'm not rushing in that direction, but it is a medium that I appreciate greatly.
Any recommendations you could give us in terms of books that, you know, either kind of old favorites of yours or ones that you may have discovered recently, or, you know, photographers who you may have discovered recently?
I mean, there are a number of people that I think understand the medium very well. Tim Hetherington's a photographer whose books I find quite extraordinary. I think Chris Anderson understands how to make a book in a, you know, beautiful, thoughtful way that's also very cinematic. And there are so many, to be honest. But you know, if you create a book that really resonates, I think it's really a reflection of you more than any news story. You know, it's much more personal.
Yeah.
So I think the people, the photographers who are able to inject their view of the world into that medium are generally the ones who do it most successfully.
Is there anything in particular that you're working on at the moment, or are you sort of engaged in continuing some of the projects that you've already started? What's the kind of plan for the immediate future?
Well, I'm beginning a project that I'm very excited about, and it's very early stages. But I'm beginning a project in Zimbabwe, looking at sort of evolution of Zimbabwean identity in a post-Mugabe Zim, to try to understand how, you know, decades of oppressive leadership have shaped this space, and the where it's going forward. It feels like an incredibly hopeful but fragile moment in a country that I find fascinating and extraordinarily beautiful. So I'm excited to engage in that space more and spend some time in Zim this year.
That's a really good one. I think that definitely needs to be explored, you know, as a story. So
I'm partnering with some sort of extraordinary Zimbabwean filmmaker Nyasha Kanhara and Zoe Flood, who's her mother is Zimbabwean. So we're thinking quite hard about the best way to tell that story.
I mean, just in terms of sort of, I think you've already kind of touched upon the importance of applying for grants and bursaries and all those, you know, awards and, you know, ways to fund projects and in a way also finding collaborators is a kind of similar process. And I'm just wondering about, you know, for the listeners who, you know, might benefit from your experience of having done that, what is there a very kind of conscious process that you go through in terms of finding funding and stuff? I mean, is it just simply a matter of doing a Google search, or you know, do you have to be very active in keeping a close eye on, you know, what the options are out there? Because all these bursaries and grants seem to be, you know, it's quite a fluid thing, and they do come up quite frequently. You know, ones which didn't exist before suddenly are out there, but you have to kind of find out about them somehow. How do you do that?
Well, I feel like I'm constantly trying to seek out those opportunities. And, you know, there are the grants that we, you know, generally in this industry all know about and are all kind of competing for. And then I think that you have to think much more creatively about how to get support for this work, because unfortunately editorial assignments are becoming increasingly short. And, you know, I think there are exciting things happening in that space and the opportunity to kind of build out these interactive stories online. And there's so much richness there, but it's not financial. and so if you want to be doing longer personal work, you generally have to be finding another way of doing that. So the ability to write proposals, to be creative in the sources that you look to for funding, is an increasingly important skill to have.
I mean, I presume that's one of the things that you try and instill into the students that, you know, who come to you for advice. What other things do you, you know, advise people? What kind of things do people tend to want to ask you about? Is it very pragmatic stuff about how the hell do I earn a living, or is it about how do I improve my photography? Because those two things are incredibly different issues.
Well, they're different, but they're the same. I mean, you know, we have our left and right side of our brains, and they work together. You have to, in this field, to be successful today in this moment in this field, I think you have to have a deeper understanding that this is your business, that while you are a creative person in this space, this is also your business, and to think about it in those terms. But then you also have to shift away from that and say, you know, well, what stories do I want to be telling and how do I want to be telling them? And if your work, you know, it all comes down to your work. It all comes down to the strength of your photography or your filmmaking and how you are able to communicate a story and how that resonates with the people viewing it. If you don't have that, none of the rest of it matter. But that is, in most cases, no longer enough. So you need both.
Well, we're done. And I'm gonna let you get on with your day. But thank you so much.
Such a pleasure talking with you.
Pleasure talking to you. And I've really enjoyed you know, meeting you. And I look forward to kind of keeping an eye on all the stuff that comes out from Kenya or wherever you may be in the future. But yeah, thanks, Nicole. It was really great to meet you.
Thank you so much.